Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The news out of Detroit the past year or so has had one common thread. Big car makers are getting smaller as their market share drops. Sales are down, losses are up, tens of thousands of people have been laid off or offered buyouts. But what if the conventional wisdom is not so wise? Published reports today say General Motors might be getting bigger. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's the 16th of February, and it's great to have you here on this Friday. Let's say right up front that both General Motors and Chrysler have issued official no comments. But earlier this week, Daimler Chrysler's chairman was very much on the record. He said all options to turn around his struggling company were on the table. Don't know if that meant he'd sell the Chrysler Group to GM, but it would take care of the restructuring the company announced earlier this week. Whether it would do anything for GM is another story entirely. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into why one very troubled automaker might want to buy another.
Automotive News first reported that GM and Chrysler were talking about a buyout, but neither company will comment, and analysts are skeptical.
I don't think this makes a lot of sense unless the purchase price is zero.
Peter Morisi teaches business at the University of Maryland. He says Chrysler is burdened by the same labor costs GM is battling. Eric Merkel with research firm IRN says GM is also struggling with too much production capacity and too many brands.
What Chrysler would do for them is it would give them more excess capacity and it would give them more brands to manage. And it seems like it would be an awful lot to bite off.
Tom Libby with J.D. Power sees one possible explanation for a buyout.
GM wants to remain number one in the world, wants to increase their share and volume in North America to stay ahead of Toyota worldwide, and this is a way to do it.
Even if the two were serious about a deal, former American Motors Company chairman Gerald Myers doubts the Justice Department would look kindly on it. He says together GM and Chrysler would dominate 37% of the U.S. market.
And with a Democrat Congress looking over the shoulder of the regulators, I don't think there's a chance that Washington will go along with a combination of the two companies outright.
For now, GM and Chrysler may be satisfied with a smaller-scale partnership. News reports say the two are in talks to develop a large SUV. Given the recent decline in SUV and truck sales, analysts question that idea, too. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here's another entry in the company's possibly doing weird things sweepstakes. Shares of AMR, the parent company of American Airlines, jumped almost 2% today on takeover rumors. Business Week's reporting Goldman Sachs and British Airways might be interested in making a purchase. It goes from bad to worse in the housing industry. New home construction plunged 14% last month. Residential buildings now at its lowest point in 10 years. Part of that January drop was after a warm December, where contractors broke ground on an unusually high number of houses. But a look at the year-over-year numbers takes the wind out of those sales pretty quickly. From January 06, housing starts are down 38%. Ashley Milne-Tite has more on what looks like a never-ending search for the bottom of the housing market.
The drop was far greater than Wall Street expected and came after a couple of months of gains. Real estate analyst Mike Larson is with Weiss Research. He says the negative numbers represent the fallout from the housing boom and all that frenzied construction.
It just goes back to the fact we have so many empty homes on the market that builders have no incentive to build. They have to work through all those homes they have for sale on the market.
Not to mention the homes individuals are looking to sell. He says it'll take a big decline in construction to work off the inventory. Ken Simonson is chief economist with the Associated General Contractors of America. He agrees the housing market is still months away from touching bottom. Bad news for home builders and their employees.
More than 100,000 jobs have disappeared over the last year in home building, and I think that we're going to see a further contraction.
Still, he says the economy as a whole can withstand the fall in home building pretty well. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
About the only thing up in the air today in Washington was the vote count on that Iraq resolution in the House. 246 to 182 was the final tally. The vote ended 3 days' worth of five-minute speeches, hundreds of them packed with flag-waving and support for the troops. Left unsaid but not forgotten was how to pay for those troops. Eric Nealer reports from Washington on Democratic plans to force the president's hand.
Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania has been leading the Democratic charge to limit the flow of money to Iraq. In a video released on MoveCongress.com, Murtha outlined his plan to restrict deployments. It would require troops take more specialized training and get a year's rest before heading back. Murtha said his plan will prevent the so-called surge authorized by President Bush.
They know they can't sustain the surge if this resolution passes the House and the Senate, and the president could veto it, but then he wouldn't have any money.
That's because Murtha's troop restrictions are tied to a war funding bill that would pay for the 21,000 extra troops. On the House floor today, Republican Adam Putnam of Florida echoed critics who said Murtha's plan undercuts military personnel.
And we certainly don't support our troops when we attach strings to the funding needed to ensure that when they need help, it is on the way.
Military analyst Lauren Thompson says that if Murtha's bill passes and Congress limits how the president conducts and pays for the war, a political battle royale will follow.
We really don't know how this will come out, because although it's true the president can veto any legislation and probably prevail, in the process he would be vetoing a money bill.
Today's vote was a non-binding resolution against the war. Murtha's troop plan will be voted on later this month. In Washington, I'm Eric Nealer for Marketplace.
Violence on TV is okay, just no sex, please. That pretty well sums up the state of federal regulation on what can be shown during most hours of the day. But Pat Loeb reports the Federal Communications Commission is considering some new rules on violent programming.
Congress requested an FCC report on TV violence almost 3 years ago. A draft now circulating suggests that the commission regulate violent programming the way it does sexual content or profanity. Consider this scene from the show 24. The main character, Jack Bauer, stabs himself in the stomach.
I have to make it look like I was injured during the attack.
The show is broadcast at 9 p.m. during family viewing hours. If Congress accepts the report, such scenes would be barred from broadcast between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. Child advocate Patty Miller of Children Now says the group welcomes FCC oversight.
There are some very serious consequences of prolonged exposure to television violence for children. And this is really a public health issue, and we need to be concerned about this.
But Jonathan Rintels of the Center for Creative Voices in Media says the problem with such regulations is that they are vague and violate free speech.
Are we going to censor the news? Are we going to censor sports? I mean, one person's violence is another person's hockey game.
Cable companies are balking, too. Their content is not regulated by the FCC, but the draft report recommends that Congress mandate a family tier of cable programming or a la carte choices for parents. The report is still in its early stages, but several lawmakers, including Hillary Clinton and John McCain, have expressed support for tighter regulation of violent programming. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Investors took a breather. Today we'll have the details, and we'll check the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Iraq's not the only place congressional Democrats are holding tight to the purse strings. New York Congresswoman Nita Lowey said today she won't let go of $86 million. The Bush administration wants to send the money to the Palestinian Authority to buck up Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas against Hamas, the party that controls most of that government. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice left for the Middle East this afternoon. She'll be holding talks on Monday with Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. And Israelis in the Palestinian territories are keeping a close eye on both leaders for signs of what might happen to them and the settlements they live in. Orly Halpern took a guided tour.
You're living Jewish history when you live out here. And you look at this view. You can't get this anywhere. You can't get this in the center of Israel, where you can't afford the housing anyway. I mean, this is spectacular.
That's Marcy Oster. She's a religious Jew and a mother of five who moved to the West Bank from Cleveland, Ohio. She's taking me around the American neighborhood of the settlement. There are two-story homes, neat lawns, everyone speaks English. It reminds her of back home.
We love it here. We love the English-speaking community. We wanted to live the way we lived in America.
but she and other religious Jews have another reason for living here in the Palestinian territories.
We view this, obviously, as land that was given to the Jews by God, and therefore we have a right to live here.
Many native secular Israelis also moved their families here. The Israeli government gave housing grants and great mortgage interest rates in order to encourage Jews to come and settle in the Palestinian territories. But that all changed in 2000, when the Second Intifada broke out. Palestinians wanted settlers out. They shot at their cars, made suicide bomb attacks inside their communities. Many, like Sarah Ventura, who moved here in 1989, want to leave.
Since there was a terror attack at the shopping center, we live in fear, and there is still stone throwing. Just 2 weeks ago, they threw stones on the car of someone from my work, so we just don't know what to do anymore.
Sarah and her husband Suri bought their 262-square-foot apartment for $73,000. Now it's worth only $30,000. As violence rose, prices dropped. Then last year, the Kadima Party ran and won on a platform to withdraw settlements from the West Bank and leave the land for a Palestinian state. The government was going to compensate settlers for their homes, but has since reneged on the plan, forcing Sarah and her husband to stay and wait. Benny Ross, a bus driver and a semi-professional singer, is tired of waiting. He's pushing the Israeli parliament to pass a bill to compensate settlers who leave voluntarily. He calls it the One House Movement.
I need help from people to push the government to do something with the Palestinians so it would be more easy for me to get out.
Benny hasn't gotten much support for his bill, and his movement has made him very unpopular with some of his neighbors. The religious and ideological ones don't ever want to move. They're worried that Benny's plan will provoke the government to remove all the settlers out. But Benny keeps trying because he feels like he doesn't have a choice.
I bought a house here in $120,000. And today, my house cost only $50,000. And what I can do with $50,000 and four kids, I can even to buy even one room.
Benny was recently fired from his singing and bus driving jobs, and now he's looking for work outside the settlement. In the meantime, he waits, like Sarah and Suri, until the government agrees to close down the settlements, a day that Marcy and her religious neighbors hope never comes.
If the government told me I had to pick up and leave, I would do that. I might not agree with it, and I certainly hope I would get fair compensation for my home, but I would do it.
For now, the Israeli government has taken the divisive issue off its agenda and says it won't discuss it at the U.S.-backed peace summit this coming Monday. In Karnei Shomron, I'm Orly Halpern for Marketplace.
Down to Dallas we go. That stockbroker and business analyst guy we talk to every now and then is down there, David Johnson. How are you, David?
I'm just great. Welcome. It's good to see you. We've had a heck of a week, haven't we?
Yeah, a heck of a week. Interesting, you might even say, eh?
Oh, it's fascinating. Last week was just boring. The stock market was on hold. It was, I guess, consolidating the gains, you know, that it had. Mm-hmm. Boy, this one had a lot of pizzazz. We had, you know, my favorite friend and the man I want to be when I grow up, Ben Bernanke.
Yes, him.
Wow. We were all, it was Valentine's Day. I remember it like it was day before yesterday. It was Valentine's Day, and we were all trembly. And then, bam, the Fed blasted out the advanced text. And you started scanning and scanning, and there it was in the third paragraph, and I've got it right here because I'm going to decoupage it. Inflation pressures appear to have abated somewhat following a run-up during the first half of 2006. Woohoo!
So that in turn means what for interest rates?
It means that interest rates are not going to go up. Maybe they're going to go down. Means the economy's good. Means Goldilocks is alive and well. Means corporate America. But did you see that? Buying back all their stock this week?
Yeah.
But $7 billion worth from,
right.
3M,
from 3M,
Honeywell.
Exactly.
And so that was exciting.
Well, then
how about all the stuff today? All the car stuff? All the airplane stuff?
Yeah, let's talk about that airplane stuff. We talked about it a little bit in our morning meeting today. We thought immediately of you. You're an airline guy. What's your take on AMR, the parent company of American Airlines?
Maybe this one makes more sense. I mean, Business Week has this column. They always have three stocks that they highlight. And that's sort of one of those often wrong but never in doubt columns. But it's always provocative. And so they said Goldman Sachs and British Airways might be talking about buying out AMR, the parent of American Airlines, maybe paying as much as $11 billion, you know, which is like $52 a share, which is a lot considering you could have had it just a few years ago for about a buck and a quarter.
Compare contrast, though, for me, would you? This the Delta U.S. Airways thing that went about, what, 2-3 weeks ago. Where does this stand on that scale?
Well, this one, I don't think this one's going to happen, at least right away. I mean, it would really surprise me. But this one would make more sense. The international carriers linking up, and you'd have an Atlantic, you know, North Atlantic, and African and Asian connections, and a strong domestic and, you know, U.S., and then Latin America out of America. That would make a lot of sense. I'm telling you, that U.S. Air, that Delta thing was never going to go together. It was oil and water. It was two completely different cultures. Oh, I'm out of time. There's one other thing.
All right, what?
You ever seen a take under?
No, I'm not sure I want to know, though.
Mills, you know, Mills that owns the big discount, you know, malls and things like that. Yeah, the stock was trading over 26. They got a buyout bid, which they accepted at $25.25 today. Instead of a takeover, it was a take under.
Investor confidence, I think, is the phrase. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good long weekend.
All righty, you too. Coming up, selling out in the subway.
They shouldn't be billboards for corporate self-promotion, and New York City is not some kind of corporate plantation where we sell everybody's eyeballs to Madison Avenue.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rolled forward 2 points today to end things up at 12,767. The NASDAQ reversed just a hair to finish at 2,496. The S&P 500 lost a point, about a tenth of 1%. It came in at 1,455 at the bell. For the week, the Dow and the NASDAQ both gained 1.5%. The S&P 500 put on about 1.2%. The view is not so good for Microsoft. CEO Steve Ballmer said today sales forecasts for its new operating system, Vista, were overly sunny. Microsoft shares thundered down almost 2.5% after that. The buyout buzz got engines revving at Daimler Chrysler. Shares motored forward more than 4.25%. General Motors lost some traction, though it was down about 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday, President's Day. U.S. markets take a 3-day weekend in honor of the holiday. In Mount Vernon, President and Mrs. Bush participate in ceremonies marking the 275th birthday of George Washington. And a third state grants more rights to gay couples. Legislation goes into effect allowing gay civil unions in New Jersey. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. They weren't just debating the war on Capitol Hill today. There were also hearings on the state of the economy. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke gave his opinions earlier this week. As Johnson just told us, he said inflation looks like it will weaken, and numbers out today on wholesale prices backed him up. But the House Financial Services Committee was after more than macroeconomics. Fairness was on the agenda. More precisely, how to balance economic growth with social fairness. We gave Congressman Barney Frank a call. He's a Democrat from Massachusetts and the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, good to speak with you.
Thank you.
If you look at the numbers, sir, if you just look at unemployment and inflation and gross domestic product, the economy seems to not be doing so badly. Why do you feel the need for this conversation now?
Well, because the economy and the people in the economy are not identical. And we have this problem, which even President Bush acknowledged last week, that inequality has been increasing. Now, inequality is necessary in a capitalist system. It performs a lot of important functions. But the problem has been that real wages, take-home pay for the average worker, and I'm talking about the great majority of workers, has been somewhat negative. It's actually declined a little bit. We have a good gross domestic product, but it has unfortunately, the increase has gone disproportionately to a very small number of people.
Just to make sure I understand, it seems to me you're making sort of a moral argument here that you have to get people in the economy to buy into what the government's doing, both the Congress and the presidency, before any economic changes are going
to
happen.
Oh, yeah. It's a moral argument to me. That is, I think it is wrong to have a situation in which people who work very hard because of the circumstances legally and otherwise in which they find themselves don't get increases. I think that there's a moral problem here. But it also becomes a political problem. We're in gridlock now. What's happened now is that the average citizen has said, look, don't come to me and tell me you want a trade bill. Don't come to me and tell me that I should support a more generous immigration policy from the standpoint of letting people in, because I think I'm getting hurt by it. People who want to see trade promotion authority expanded, people who want to see an immigration bill of the sort that the president talked about and want to see no obstacles to the implementation of technology must understand that as long as we have these obstacles to fair treatment for working people, the political system won't allow it.
Are you ready to try to deny things to the president like fast track and like an immigration bill if he doesn't at least listen to your argument?
Yes and no. I certainly am prepared to deny him fast track and the trade bills. On other areas, like immigration, I am supportive of the administration position, but until we do something about this anger, I'm afraid it won't be successful.
Let me get back to your hearings for just a second. I spent some time watching you and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke on C-SPAN. You seem to spend a lot of time on inflation and the Fed's policy on interest rates. It seemed to me you didn't really buy Mr. Bernanke's arguments about the way the economy's headed.
Well, I think that there is a bias there to focus on the potential danger of inflation while ignoring the very real current danger of inequality. Now, he's acknowledged inequality, and I appreciate that, and that's a real advance. I mean, you don't generally get that from a Republican-appointed chairman of the Federal Reserve. But I was quoting his own monetary report. He said, first of all, in the monetary report, production is below the economy's potential and will stay that way for a few quarters and will probably get up to potential but not above it. Secondly, he said, inflation seems to be under control. Reading those two, I'm then surprised to turn the page and see them say, and therefore, our major concern is to worry about inflation happening. And if you focus excessively on the possibility of inflation, even when there is no real indication of it, then you are inclined to do things that make it harder to reach the full economic potential. And I do think growth alone doesn't provide the kind of equity I'd like to see, but the absence of growth guarantees that we won't have it.
Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
If you think your daily commute's crowded, consider this. On an average weekday, about 5 million people ride the rails of the New York City transit system. There are almost 600 miles of subway tracks, served by nearly 500 stations, which take more than just pocket change to keep running. So subway officials are taking a cue from professional sports, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
A lot of New York subway stations have names that are purely functional.
Here's the 33rd Street. Next stop, Queensboro Plaza.
Others are practically icons.
Grand Central, transfer available 456, Times Square Shuttle, Metro North.
A couple of years ago, the MTA proposed a novel way to raise money for the ailing and overworked system. Sell corporate naming rights to the subway stations, much like cities have been doing with their sports arenas. Now the transit authority's under new leadership, and innovative financing is back on the table. Gary Ruskin heads Commercial Alert, a nonprofit that tries to limit the reach of advertising. He thinks civic names should reflect a community's history and values.
They shouldn't be billboards for corporate self-promotion, and New York City is not some kind of corporate plantation where we sell everybody's eyeballs to Madison Avenue.
But beyond the moral issue is a practical one. Many of the city's subway stations are damp, crumbling, smelly places. Who'd want their company name associated with that? Kevin Bartram negotiates sponsorships and naming rights. He says the trick to successful deals is making sure the public realizes it's getting more than a few corporate logos on the wall.
That's going to be harder for everybody to see the value in that. than if that's attached to some form of refurbishment of the station, some new services that are being provided to the subway riders, some other beautification project.
He says there are limits to where corporate names should appear, especially when you're talking about public spaces.
The stations that would be the most valued by companies to name would also be those that would probably be met with the greatest resistance by the public.
It's easy to see why Goldman Sachs might want to own a station like Wall Street, or why Macy's might want to name the stop at its flagship store on 34th Street. But the possibilities are endless. Maybe Clorox would like to take on a particularly dirty station, or Bug Killer Raid could adopt one where roaches are a problem. Robert Passwell studies public transport at City University of New York. He says selling naming rights would only bring in a few million dollars at each station. It may sound like a lot, but he says it's actually pretty paltry.
When you look at the billions of dollars budget that the Transit Authority has, it really doesn't go very far, and it doesn't actually solve any problems. It puts a small amount of cash in for what, to repaint one station or something?
He says the real issue is that the MTA has been underfunded for decades, and the city needs to come up with ways to bring in a consistent cash flow. A new tax system that makes landlords pay for proximity to the subway system, or a deal to make developers chip in for upkeep. He says in any case, if the city has to look for corporate sponsorship, there are better ways to do it than something like big golden arches over the ticket booths. Of course, if companies do start putting their names on stations, it won't be the first time. One of the Big Apple's best-known spots,
Times Square is the next step,
is named for the famous newspaper whose offices were located there. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, you've probably never heard of a guy named Robert Adler, but chances are you use his most famous invention every day. Mr. Adler died yesterday. He was an engineer for Zenith Electronics. Back in 1956, he was the co-inventor of the Zenith Space Command television remote control. The clicker's gotten a bad rap in the 50 years it's been around. Just think no farther than the term couch potato. But that didn't stop Mr. Adler from inventing. The Patent Office published his most recent work on touchscreen technology back on the 1st of February. Robert Adler was 93 years old. And that's Marketplace on a Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lifted a mere 2 points, but still a new record, 12,767. The NASDAQ fell back a point. The S&P 500 lost a point as well. That's about a tenth of 1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up Monday, the latest scam on the market, shady ethanol producers.
It seems like their process is pyrolysis. Pyrolysis has been around since the days of ancient Egypt. The Egyptians used it to make charcoal. In the 70s, it was used to make fuel from used tires. Not much new has happened. It's just been dusted off and presented as the solution to America's energy problems.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.